Shelley Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelley.
April 5, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me babble all this stuff right now. So anyway, it's Tears Day, Tuesday, the second broadcast day of the O'Shelley Effect. I'm going to put that windscreen back in front of my microphone because I took it away right before. And now I don't like the way it sounds. Whatever it is, it's live. Here we are, Tuesday. What am I doing tonight? Well, I got an author on who wrote a seriously short book, and he's been on my show before, but the sad fact is that I didn't get a chance to really read the whole thing last time. And I really wanted to bring him back because I felt uncomfortable with some of what he was saying in the book that I knew about, and now I've got a completely different view on it, and I want to discuss it with you guys. So Sam Idoletta is with me. And he's going to be in the first hour. In the second hour, we're going to visit again with Christy Aphrodite, who wants to clarify some of the things from last week's Tuesday appearance, because she's all about natural solutions and giving people information about things they might be able to just find, I don't know, under their feet, wherever they may be, that might be healthy things for you to consume. I got a whole email from somebody about dandelions and how they didn't realize you can eat those. Given that I got a vowel at the end of my name, I know you eat dandelions, but anyway, we'll get into that in the next hour. This hour, definitely different. And the name of the book is Dancing with My Fate. Okay. Sounds like it's going to be one of those 1,000-page tomes. All right. It's not. First thing is it's less than 100 pages in length. And I was just discussing with him right before we went live that actually his conclusion ends even earlier than that, because there's a glossary of terms and a bibliography. So, interesting book, and really interesting for the effect more than the content in my mind, but I'll get to that in a minute. Sam Idoletta, how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm really good, Chuck. Thanks for having me on. It's a blast being on your show again. I appreciate you inviting me back. Looking forward to digging in.
It's funny because, just full disclosure, I mean, Sam actually listens to a lot of the shows, and I meant to get back to him quicker than I have, and frankly, well, there was a bunch of stuff going on, as you guys might know if you're regular listeners, and I get an email amongst all my other emails that says, you know, thanks for the shout-out, but you actually misquoted me in your shout-out. Because I mentioned Sam on a show recently. And so I was like, okay, you know what? First of all, he's right. I did misquote him. And secondly, wow, okay, you're still listening to the show. And I was like, coincidentally, I actually want to get you back on soon. So really grateful that you could take me up on it and be here, because I promised I would revisit the book when I got a chance to study it. And here we are. I generally keep to my word. So anyway, Sam, let's refresh everybody else's memory, though, just in case they forgot about it. I mean, we have another interview in the archive, so you can go through it. So I'm not going to go through too much of his history. But, I mean, he has a military background. He certainly saw that things were not quite flowing correctly in the world around him. And, you know, there's a time in which you decide to create this piece of content here, which I do hold in my hands and do think is very interesting. So why don't you start off telling us about the desire to write the book and what the motivation was before we go into the first chapter, which, in the title of the chapter, we mentioned the trickster god, if you will, or at least one of them. And I want to start with that and that sort of esoteric bent that begins at the beginning, oddly enough. But before we go there, tell us about what motivated you to write this.
Yeah, good question, Chuck. So, I mean, I've been kind of part of what you would call, you know, conspiracy culture, or, truth seekers. You know, it's a problematic just kind of defining it. But, you know, my dad introduced me to the Vince Foster conspiracy when I was, you know, still a kid, probably way too young than I should have been introduced to those things. But, you know, he was of the kind of far right worldview. But, you know, at that time when Clinton was in the White House, there were a lot of conspiracies about, you know, the various things. And this was kind of the early days of the conspiracy culture, which, I mean, I know, you know, you've talked a lot about that on your show with, you know, Ron Paul and other figures who were pretty influential back then. And, you know, as I grew up and kind of matured my own ideas, I started to, you know, I had this idea of like, well, maybe what if the conspiracy includes that the Republicans saying that the liberals are the conspiracy is also part of the conspiracy, you know, and I had that thought, you know, in my teens. But, you know, I didn't really start putting the pieces together, which I think is also a misnomer because you never really put the pieces together completely. But, you know, when I joined the military and then deployed to Iraq, kind of saw the, I don't want to, mislabel it, but I think that the word schizophrenic does actually describe aptly the, you know, level of contradiction between what I was experiencing and observing, you know, with boots on the ground.
You see, I wish schizophrenic was an accurate title. It's not. There's a misnomer too, because I think what you really mean is the very bipolar nature, because schizophrenia is not necessarily incoherent or contradictory. When people have it and their thought patterns, which people assume, are clashing with each other, and quite frankly, they used to equate it with what they call the modern term escapes me, but split personalities, basically.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's not right.
Dissociative personality.
Dissociative personality.
Dissociative.
Right.
Yes, that's a much better word to describe it, because that's exactly what it was. Where, you know, it was where fantasy ended and reality began, mm-hmm. was unclear, even on the ground. You know, we were this close to doing a brigade jump, you know, because I was in the 82nd Airborne, and mm-hmm. I remember there was like an anticipated 10% casualty rate, and no one was going to be shooting at us, mind you. The casualty rate was just because the ground was hard, because there wasn't like a good place to do the jump, and there was no real combat reason for the jump other than getting awards, but that we were going to do it. And the reason they ended up calling it off is because of expense. At the end, I think the general or whoever, you know, was like, too expensive. But our commander wanted to do it.
Now, the year that you deployed to Iraq, because I am older than you, so I'm going to tell you that, and I think I mentioned this last time, but when I was coming out of high school, you know, Desert Storm, Desert Shield happened, so there was that. And frankly, my friends who went there, if anybody was killed, it was generally through misadventure. They weren't killed by the Iraqi army. I mean, it just wasn't happening. But they did get killed by, you know, equipment failures, okay, stuff like this. I'm laughing a little bit because it's a nerve-wracking thing that I'm revisiting in my mind here, because this is what got people coming right out of high school at my age, got them killed, and we didn't suffer a lot of casualties during that, you know, quick action. Now, the later invasion of Iraq is a whole other story, and a common thing here, which ends up happening to seemingly any service member I've ever known who has a brain, okay, I hate to boil it down like that, is that there is some level of disillusionment that comes into play here, whether it's through my father, and you've heard me probably mention my father's story, or others. I have learned that, and I have not served myself, but I have learned that at some level, you go into a combat situation especially, disillusionment is a guaranteed medal you're coming home with, on some level. Some people more extreme than others. Some people find, you know, it horrifying what they were doing, or find it later that it was, you know, whatever. Disillusionment, as I said, is almost a guarantee with somebody that goes in and serves and goes in with the right ideas. You know, that they're there to serve their country. They're there to protect, you know, protect America, this kind of thing, like my father did, like you and I discussed at length last time we talked. So I'm not going to revisit that. But
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, regardless of how you, you go in there with ideals and you come out, because it, it doesn't really matter what specifics or individual thing happened to you, your ideals will not match what you see. Because this is the machine, this is the underbelly that, you know, the machine that fuels the economic, you know, system that underlies our you know, understanding of reality and how goods and services are maintained and how resources are extracted and, you know, geopolitics, all of that. So, you know, an 18-year-old when they're joining the military doesn't understand, you know, those subtleties. And so inevitably there's going to be a kind of period of disillusionment coming out of it. If you're observant at all, which, I mean, there were a few people that weren't, but, you know, for the majority of us, yes, I would say that was very common. And, you know, whether you stay in or you get out.
Right. At some point, the idealism that you went in with is damaged at the very least. I mean, it just has to be, And again, you know, I observe this from guys going in from 68 to 98 very easily. You know, and at 68, you're talking about post Tet Offensive and going into Vietnam and stuff like this. And obviously that was a much more ugly sort of situation than a lot of the other conflicts that followed. But then again, we get the War on Terror, and now you got all kinds of protracted events, which again, you know, serve to undermine those ideals that you go in with one way or another. But I'm just laying that out for context, because again, we were talking about your motivations here for wanting to write this book. And I also want to just note before we go any further that you mentioned the far right conspiracy world. Well, simultaneously, I always find this funny that people want to ascribe it to either the left or the right. And there are some people that identify themselves on one side or the other, and they try to own it. But you know what the truth is? The fringes always had this stuff on both sides. The deep John Burke type stuff and all that, you know, definitely interesting. Your New World Order, even your really truly neo-Nazi people and all that, they had exactly the same stuff you see in almost common conspiracy culture today, as well as leftists who were very much involved with thinking
Marxists in Europe. And I always joke that it's like the fringes on either side completely agree on the problems. They just have totally divergent view on the solutions.
True. Right.
But they completely agree on what's wrong, which is funny, you know, because they're painted as this total opposites, but really they're not.
And it's also funny because in the conspiracy points, like when you were talking about the whole thing with Vince Foster there, that was just one stage in something that got out there on the right wing side. But then again, the left wing, what were they saying? There is a vast right wing conspiracy. Of course, that phrase coined by Hillary herself, you know, against Clinton. So you had competing conspiracies, okay? And I still got questions about Vince Foster, by the way, but okay.
It's a lot that is mysterious about that. I don't want to get into it right now, but
No. I want to focus on your book. I'm just laying it out for context that because it's right-wing, left-wing. See, that's the thing. You don't come across as a right-wing thinker in here at all. And you're also not a left-wing thinker, which is interesting to me, because at some point there's usually a spoiler on the politics. And even if there is a hint here or there, I got to tell you, you're not leaning into any of it hard.
I'll take that as a compliment.
I hope you do, because, again, this is why I think this book is interesting. And in the time that I've had your book in my hands and we've had a discussion, I just want you to know I probably... there's the weenie dog letting me know something's going on. I have probably literally had to have conversations with guys that I thought were nice guys and everything that I don't even want to discuss their book on my show because it was a waste of time. And I had to try and be polite about it. So your book, A, doesn't waste my time, not just because it's short, but because there is some, there's an interesting effect that occurs here. And so I want to start with something completely out of left field, if you don't mind, which is the esoteric journey here. You immediately mentioned in your chapter title, first chapter, there is an introduction. But let's go to the first chapter where you mentioned the trickster god. Now, most people would think of Loki, and he is not well understood, I would say, although there is a pop culture version of Loki is out there, not just through the comic books, but through the common understanding. And then there is the Norse concept, which is not originally a Norse concept, but is most commonly associated with their pantheon. And you evoke that right away. Is there a reason why you chose that as your starting point in the book? You know, where you start wanting to talk about the symbolic nature of things. Help me out here.
Sure. Yep. So for me, the conception of the trickster god, I did, you know, I've read a lot of, you know, Joseph Campbell and, you know, the things about Tarot deck and, you know, various spiritual tracks, ancient tracks. I also, you know, grew up Greek Orthodox, so I mean, I'm pretty aware of, you know, some, not all, of the various spiritual traditions. However, I would say that my understanding of the trickster god, at least I tried my best to base it on an authentic engagement with a power greater than myself that exists in the universe, and what that is, you know, concretely, and how that feels, and how it feels to me is a playful trickster, you know. So to define it that way is kind of an extension of that, noticing that, you know, the irony in everyday life, the gallows humor that's all around us, like, you know, the serendipity that seems to happen, and not in like a kind of shallow way that it's like a pedantic way that's kind of expressed in, you know, Hollywood movies and stuff, but in a real way.
Well, a real world grasp on this, right, Sam, would be that many people have various superstitions that they have no idea what the root of them is, et cetera. People participate in traditional behaviors that they think are religious, and they're really just a traditional behavior which comes from a conglomeration of other things. And quite often we find syncretism or synchronicity in various events and occurrences, right? Which also causes people to be superstitious. You know, you see a cardinal, you see a black cat, you see a whatever. They adapt these different symbols and symbolisms from many places, and often they have no idea what the origin is. And obviously pattern recognition becomes a reality.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that's kind of the point is, you know, I think that, you know, the various strategies people have to explain what that pattern means, right? And I'm doing the same thing in a way. But I think for me, you know, what was very important to me in writing this book is being very careful about not taking anything for granted. Like you mentioned, traditional belief systems or, you know, all of those things are in the end based on an assumption, like ancient truth is better than, you know, today. They knew more, they were wiser. Or, you know, the newer is better because it's, you know, new and the latest and greatest is better. Like, these are both assumptions, right? Like, the ancient truth may be just a bunch of idiots from 2,000 years ago, you know? And likewise, you know, something that's peer-reviewed by the best scientists in the world, like, could be wrong, you know? So I didn't want to make any assumptions, and I wanted to base it on pure empiricism, but in a way, ironically, because, you know, this whole thing is about this relationship with this power that I don't understand, that seems to be pranking me throughout my life, you right. know? So it's like this empiricism, but also, you know, this it's kind of based on a complete intuitive leap, you know? So that I thought was interesting enough to explore and write a book about. So, I mean, I think you're kind of touching on one of the core themes of the book itself is I want to play back with the trickster God. Right. So I'm writing this book kind of just to do it, well, to see.
And obviously contained in the title, your willingness to engage with it is also a decision you make. And some people would just be the constant victim of circumstance. And I would say that, you know, although you cannot fight the current, so to speak, when you're on this watery rock, okay, you do have options to swim or not. So there are actions you can take, and some people would find themselves more captive to fate, so to speak, than others. You try to go in sort of objectively here and say, look, I don't necessarily know. I can see some patterns here. And the irony, and for somebody who says, I don't know what they're talking about right now. Well, think about this. You ever sit and say to yourself, well, of course this person called now when I'm busy. Of course there's a knock on the door when I got my hands full. Of course, you know what I'm saying? That level of irony in just commonplace things is exactly one of those things that causes you to say and causes you to act and causes you to question taking action. Should I do this right now? Because it'll almost seem like if I go and do this, something will happen. You have no information outside of past experience to tell you that you know this random occurrence might be coming your way, right? But you have an intuitive idea about it. Now, is it due to that experience? Is it due to the intrinsic versus the other form of memory? Is it, you know, and there's a lot of questions that are open here. And some people would say, well, how does he go through this in such a short span? It's very weird how he goes through this, actually. So we start with the premise that, yes, indeed, there may indeed be a prank or an irony that is just built into this experience called life. And, you know, like even if you think about the concept of, oh, well, you know, there are some people that just have to learn the hard way. Nobody says to themselves, I need to learn this the hard way. Not really. Even if they say that out loud, it's only because it's been said to them so many times. And yet you'll see them repeat a pattern based on their past experiences. And they do. They're just, you know, the hard-headed people who's like, you just got to learn this the hard way. You got to keep making that mistake over and over again. It's interesting how some people will do that. And then there are others that cannot maintain a pattern that are almost chaotic. But to them, it appears as though it's order. So trying to confront the order of the universe from this little spot, this little experience inside of a human body, is a seemingly insurmountable quest to go on. But I find this interesting. So please go on about the ironies, and let's move forward and get into that central theme, because I want to make sure that we actually cover the overall experience that is in this very short book. And again, one more time, it's Dancing with My Fate. All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it looks like it's got like those little paper dolls on the front of it in shades of blue and gray, which I also like, I got to tell you. Anyway, go right ahead, though, and explain to me how it is we get from the trickster to honest evaluation, trying to go in as open-minded as possible, and then moving forward until we get to the conclusion, which I'm going to say some very strange things about, I think. So go ahead.
All right. Yeah, so I mean, to sum up what we were just describing, it's there's a quote by Jean Baudrillard, which is, let's believe for a single instant the hypothesis that there is a fatal and enigmatic bias in the order of things. That's the assumption that I'm taking that hypothesis and I'm running with it, that there is a bias, and I have to figure out what it is and the rules of this game that we call life and the rules of the dance. you know, the steps of the dance. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the overarching theme of this book is, you know, how do I do that? I play with things like, you know, Aristotelian logic, you know, Occam's razor. I use various inductive logic methods. You know, I use all the tools that are at our disposal as human beings to discern truth. I employ them, right? In a very postmodern smorgasbord of, you know, pragmatic American mentality where I'm like, I just doing what works, you know, with no framework, you know, other than that, right?
Okay.
So that's kind of the background of this inquiry, right? And so now, you know, moving forward into what I find. So, you know, the first thing that I find is, yes, you know, this enigmatic bias, there is something to the level of irony to it. And I'm noticing that, like, you know, and not only is there an irony, there's a, like, it seems to be kind of cunning. Like, think about like desire, right? You desire something, but it always seems like you never really 100% possess the object of your desire. Like, mm-hmm. isn't that true? Like in life, you know, you go after something and you think you want it and you want it so bad and you go in after it. And then, you know, you case A, you get it. And then you're like, oh, well, that was nice. Oh man. You know,
right.
Or you're like, you know, you don't get it and it's unobtainable and you're like frustrated, you know?
Right.
There's been a few times in my life where I was like, that was exactly what I wanted, you know? Right. But even then, it, you know, then you move on and go to the next thing, you know? So it's never like this. I mean, maybe if you live your life perfect, it's like that when you die, you're 100% satisfied, maybe, but I'm not there yet. So I don't know. Right.
Well, that's the other thing too, is that this idea of sort of accomplishing things, you know, with the clock running because you have a limited amount of time. And some people would say, you know, if by the time I die, I accomplish this, or I have this, or I acquire this. And frankly, again, it's almost like this is why, when it comes to television shows and books and everything else, works of fiction, the be careful what you wish for trope is like so universally acceptable because we've all experienced that on some level, right? Where it's like, oh, I got this, but I didn't realize it would come with that. Or, you know, I could never get to this because I had an unrealistic idea about getting to it, so on and so forth. And so that's why that's always a popular thing, whether they use the vehicle, you know, the character, the device, if you will, the literary device of a genie or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's always like, listen, if you can attain the thing you want, you better be sure about what it is you want first.
Yep.
And
then, you know, you said be sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I find that in and of itself very interesting that you're framing it that way. And that I think is the fallacy, right? Because your will, what you think you want, is both you, you know, it defines you,
mm-hmm.
and it's happening to you at the exact same time.
Right.
So it's a paradox.
Exactly.
So what you want, maybe there's a part of you that, and I mean, can you not relate to an experience where like you want something and then this other part of you sneaks up on you and you sabotage yourself? Like you get the cake at 2 a.m. and, you know, I hate myself right now for doing this because I was trying to lose weight. But, you know, yeah. that's kind of a stereotypical scenario. But I think all of us can relate to that scene in one form or another where we want something,
right,
and then we actually like feel like that desire in and of itself is happening to us and that it's unfair that we want this thing, you know, that we want.
Right.
You know?
So, and this is interesting to me because, again, we're not even switching away from the overall theme of the title, because this sounds like a dance to me.
Yeah. It feels,
you
know, like a dance, right? It feels that way.
Yeah, like we're dancing through this. So before we run too low on time, because we're about halfway done already, I want to get into some other parts of this, where, again, I feel like you're stepping outside of yourself a bit, as opposed to focusing, you know, because that's always another thing. Like you said, being sure is also a fallacy. Sure, I'll absolutely stipulate to that. But also, even knowing yourself becomes this weird sort of fallacy that, you know, takes a hell of a journey. I would contend that every 10 years, if you were able to literally take a snapshot of yourself and have conversations with yourself every 10 years, you would not recognize you. You know, you might visually, but you would not recognize what's really truly in your head every 10 years or so. I mean, it's a completely different state of mind unless you're actually trapped in a serious loop where nothing has changed. I don't know anybody where nothing changes. So change is the only guarantee we seem to have, one way or another. And that makes it a little more difficult for long-term goals in my mind. Because by the time you get to something, if, say, you plan something out for the next 10 years, good luck.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be in a different mindset. Things are going to be altered one way or another, whether it is the world around you that does it or you, or the people that you choose to keep around you. One way or another, there is no way that you can have a static situation. And that is also a problem when trying to approach this and continue to live while seeking to understand the dance. Because the music keeps changing, as far as I'm concerned. So
it does, yeah.
So what do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's interesting that you led right into the kind of the next idea, which is that, you know, if there's one thing that defines modernity and our, you know, modern civilization, our modern lifestyle, it's this unwavering belief in the ability of us to assign value to something that can be exchanged, like for money. You know, like this, people have this faith that they work 40 hours and they get paid, and that's an equivalent value, and then they can buy things with that money that give them this equivalent value for the, you know, pain and suffering that they put in at work, or, you know, whatever the case may be. They think that it's this equivalence, when in reality, I mean, that's not only is there no manufacturer guarantee, I mean, it's just kind of an absurdity. If you really think about it for a second, there's no guarantee of equivalence of anything. I mean, like we just said, I mean, you could desire something and then regret it. So, I mean, even if something is well built and, you know, there's no, you know, and then on top of that, of course, there's manipulative marketing, and then, you know, there's inflation to put a cherry on top, right? So, you know, even the value of the thing that's supposed to represent the static, you know, equivalence of value, which is money, is not even static, you know, based on our own logic of economics that we created for ourselves to define this very thing.
Well, and here's the thing, is even if you codify it into a particular metric, right? The metric is based on agreement with other people. And there's your problem also, because those people are experiencing changes too. Like, I could tell you that this is the easiest part of your concept to swallow for me, because frankly, I have many times in my life lost every single thing.
Yeah, same.
Okay. So it's, you know, all the things went, all the people went, everything went. Okay. Yeah. And it's start again. So nothing is retainable in my mind. The longest relationship I've ever had is with Kim, and that's 8 years, right? Everybody else disappears, goes away. Generally about 5 years is their shelf life. And that's the way it is. And I accept it, ironically. You know, and so if you don't have this idea of retention, and you understand that everything is transient, this becomes a lot easier to sort of deal with the changes in my mind. But then again, some people would say I'm wrong. And see, therein lies another problem. Like I said, this is based on agreements with other people, and they are going through different changes. So by the time you get there again, if you do, and my title for my book is at this point is Everything Breaks, by the way. And that's my idea of my life. Everything breaks. Everything becomes no longer functional at some point. And sooner than you think. But that's based on a worldview that is given to me through my experiences. Yours are a little different. And therefore, in my mind, we could just use us as a sample and say, look, everybody listening to us is going to have a different point of view on this. So continue on, though, about this transient sort of thing that you have to sort of understand and be flexible with if you're going to maintain not really getting depressed about the fact that it almost seems like I'm saying you can never actually accomplish anything you want to accomplish. That's not what I'm saying, if that's the way it's being taken. It's just that you have to have some flexibility when it comes to, you know, the goalposts being moved. When it comes to you deciding you don't want to go for those goalposts, you want to go for the ones after them, or you want to go for the one that's up in the air. I don't know.
Right.
But you have to have a variable. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add that, I mean, to me, the most important part that I hope people internalize from this part of the conversation is that to believe that there is this, you know, static value can be a weapon. Mm-hmm. You know, the belief in that, it's something that's employed by, you know, from cult leaders to politicians to, you know, manipulative, you know, business practices to, you know, you name it. This idea that, you know, oh, you do this for me and then later you'll get this. And if you can convince someone to do that, then you kind of, you know, you can control them that way. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's something that I want people to think about and understand for their own, you know, growth and their own, you know, inner understanding of themselves, is that, you know, whatever you think you're going to get because somebody's telling you you're going to get that, you might not get that, you know.
See, and I would
you
say
probably won't get that.
Yeah,
you
and
probably won't. And so, even if you do,
yeah,
it might not be the thing you think it is.
Well, see, I have a hard question then for you. I hope it's a hard question. Maybe not. Would you say that it is most productive to not allow yourself to be absolutely committed, welded, so to speak, to expectations, and to disallow others from setting those expectations? Would those things be a primary thing as far as making your experience a little more user-friendly in this life? What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, there's the risk of, you know, out of a sense of fear of being manipulated by these practices, mm-hmm. you know, having this false sense of self-control. And, you know, that goes back to this paradox of the will, you know, because we also don't really have, I mean, if somebody has this glittering object in the distance that we want and they're telling us that we can get it, we really want to believe them, mm-hmm. you know, I mean. And so that's, you know, that's happened to me, obviously, you know, that's happened to me a ton of times. And, right. you know, I think that, you know, it's almost equally, dangerous to kind of completely put your guard up and never, you know, and never believe that you can know the truth or, you know, achieve the object of your desire. I think there's, so we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves in the book, but you know, I want to mention that here to answer your question specifically, because
I
don't think that that the answer is just to like put your guard up and always be hypervigilant, you know, against the threat of manipulation. I just think it's important to acknowledge, mm-hmm. you know, admit it, you know, it's that easy. And it's one of the oldest tricks in the book. In fact, you know, they say, you know, but what's the oldest profession, right? Like, that profession depends on this trick, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, this is something that's kind of fundamental to humanity. And, you know, in a way, it kind of feels sometimes like the trickster God is doing this, you know? Well, so that's part of it too, right? Like, see, you gotta wonder.
And that's where I gotta get into this, because now the big question for me at this point is, so what you're telling me is that it's all about really being sold happiness, and you must buyer beware. Because again, whether it's the oldest profession or it's a double cheeseburger, right? The thing is that people want to sell you something that is meant to satisfy usually one of the most baser urges one way or another. When they're selling you clothing, why are they doing that? Because, you know, obviously it's part of one of those baser urge systems. Okay. And somebody trying to sell you happiness, a lot of people really want to buy happiness one way or another. And I don't necessarily mean just with cash in a transaction. The whole thing that we've talked about so far, the idea that working towards something is always a guarantee. I mean, there's a disillusion I got earlier on where it was like, you know what, if I work hard enough and I'm nice and loyal, everything will be fine. No. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. Somebody always tries to sell you something. And one way or another, if you want to buy it, you're going to try to buy into it. Even if it's less than realistic. It's difficult to discern this, right? So at some point, you have to have an evaluation about how much you're going to allow the influence of somebody peddling whatever it is. And it could be, by the way, a relationship that they're peddling to you, you know, kind of like if you're my friend or if you're my partner, you know, one way or another, people are always trying to sell you. I see, here I am back to thinking like a transactional person. I got to tell you, it's very difficult for me to snap that pattern from when I was a kid, that everything is a transaction.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I think that at this stage of the conversation, the thing that I want to tell people is this: we are what we see ourselves as when we remember to look, right? So, so when that, what that means and the importance of that truth is that we get to decide what we ought to be ashamed of or not, you know, what we should feel ashamed of inside or not. No one gets to define that for us except us. There's some danger there, right? And we can talk about that too. But ultimately, that is the truth, right? So the reason that's so powerful is because, you know, yes, we're going to go after, like the fool in the tarot, we're going to go after that glittering object in the distance that, you know, is being promised to us. And if we do this, then we'll get that. And we're going to fall for this and we're going to do this over and over again because we're human beings, right? But we shouldn't be ashamed of this, you know, because that's our humanity, right? If we, you know, we strive for the unknown. We're explorers, we're, you know, adventurers, and we have the courage to pursue, you know, more than just these, like, animals. You know, most animals will just do a cyclical pattern over and over again for their whole life, and then they die. What makes us human is that we try to explode the boundaries of our cyclical survival patterns and explore into something else. And so that's a good thing. I mean, it's not a bad thing. Maybe it's not a good thing, but it's definitely not a bad thing only, you know? So, I mean, to say that that's, you know, but we are led to believe, I think, and this is part of the trick, that, you know, when, because of this idea of, you know, our responsibility, right? You're a responsible consumer. If you get duped, it's on you. You know, you didn't see through the manipulative tactic. Mm-hmm. That's on you. No, that's on them. That's not on me. Mm-hmm. You tried to manipulate me. You're not a good person. It's nothing to do with me. All I thought was, oh man, this thing is nice and I want it and looks nice, you know? You know, so that's a really important thing. I want people to really if there's one thing I could kind of preach it, is that, because, you know, and yeah, maybe that sounds kind of corny, but it's made a huge difference for me, because I used to walk around, you know, feeling bad of, oh, I'll never get to the bottom. You know, the conspiracy exists and they're gaslighting me and I keep falling for the wrong thing and I keep putting my faith in false, you know, idols, and then they deceive me and I'm upset. You know, I was wrong about this element of the, you know, this conspiracy or that. And, you know, nah, man, screw that. I'm trying to get to the truth. I'm authentically being myself. I'm going about things, you know, in the best way that I can.
Right.
And that's all I can do. And that's all anybody can do.
Well, right. And to clean your intentions, okay, in my mind, one must understand that, yes, indeed, shame and fear have places, but they should not be the governing, the dominant governing principles of anything you do. You should not act simply out of shame, simply out of fear, because when you do, it just seems as though it attracts more of it, one way or another. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be afraid of certain things that are logical to be afraid of, or it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be shameful of things that are truly shameful. But if you allow that to only dominate your behaviors, that's another thing, right? Because now, I'm too afraid to speak up. I'm too afraid to pursue something. You're embarrassed because you're being mocked for whatever, and therefore you're taking on whatever it is these people are projecting at you and allowing it to dictate your behavior. So I'm very much about abandoning as much fear as possible at all times. And shame is usually just a rather useless exercise in reminiscence.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people that have something to be ashamed of in this life, but
sure,
to me, that is, if you really drill down, there are very few circumstances that deserve shame.
Right.
You know, that's an extreme emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And we collectively attribute, you know, people feel shame because they, you know, wanted the candy bar at the store, or, you know, people feel shame for such, you know, and meanwhile, the ad for the candy bar, it's like, you know, it's like in, you know, it's just the amount of advertising just sticking your desires in your face and rubbing your nose in it, it's like obscene, you know, in our society.
Right.
And that's okay, you know, because they're, you know, because they're millionaire advertisers, they get to do that. And that's not immoral at all.
Right. Now, look, before I let you run to conclusion and give you my conclusion on your conclusion, I want to enter something from the chat room, which I think is a very good statement, and just let you run with it, which is, use your ego as a guide. Use your ego as a helpful assistant, not a guide. I find that statement kind of interesting, and I'm wondering what you think about that.
I think that's interesting. I don't want to totally go off the rails, because ego, I associate that term with Freud and, you know, psychoanalysis
and that particular
analytic model, which we could go into.
No,
is very interesting. But
because that analytical model, I understand your prejudice immediately. Like, even taking a look at Freud, as I have at various times in my life, and trying to help people get through psychology classes, I got to tell you, it's like, oh my God, are they still doing this? You know, at what point do you say banging your head up against the wall becomes insanity? Is my answer to Freud. So I understand where your prejudice is, but I think their meaning is not necessarily Freudian in a proper sense. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made the statement they did.
Right. Yeah, right. That's what I figured. I just wanted. Yeah. I mean, so just to take it generally, I think that's very true. I mean, that's, if you, it replaced ego with what I was saying, like, as a will, your will, you know, which I think is kind of the spirit of what is being said. Yeah, I absolutely agree, because you can be enslaved to your own will.
Right.
You know, you can live a life as a slave to your will. which is kind of a weird thing to think about. But it's true. And people do live there. People live like that, which is sad.
Well, there's much more to life than your basic desires, too. And I've seen people get very much trapped in a cycle where that is all they are servicing. And if that's the case, that is what their time is consumed with. And it does not seem to have a satisfactory end for the individual who partakes of that particular path of behavior. So I would say, you know, yeah, don't let your desires go unfulfilled, but also keep them in check. Keep them reasonable.
It's a balance, yeah. And I would say don't go the other way either, where you know, there's another case where, like, you have your idea of the truth with a capital T, and that's how you live your life.
Right.
And you don't deviate from that ever, you know, and there are warning signs aplenty that, you know, because you have these desires that are cropping up and, you know, but that's evil. So don't do it.
Right.
That's the other extreme where you're like, you're not giving into your desires and they're warning you like, hey, you have, there's something on the other side that you're missing. And you know, that's equally important to avoid.
Well, sadly, that's where some people become completely dominated by the concept that there is a punishment figure waiting for them on the other side of life. And that's the only thing that seems to allow them to get through without behaving completely like sociopaths. right. So, you know, and
whether that would even happen or not is unknown, right? They're not allowing that part of themselves to even emerge to find out.
It is unknown, but fact is that it just appears that way, that it's like, you know, I would just do this and this if, and well, okay, good thing that you have the imaginary man that's going to beat you to death later, because otherwise I don't want to see what you would do.
Right.
Okay, so I don't want to go off track anymore. I want to get to the conclusion and talk to you about that. Obviously, I don't want you to give away every single thing in here. But we've gone through a few key points. We didn't get to everything. But in conclusion, after you've had this exploration, which again is very short, less than 100 pages, altogether, that includes the glossary and all of that, it's an easy read, and I do recommend the book, okay? And I'm going to tell you why after I let Sam speak about the conclusion, so to speak, here, like what you came to, what the maybe not the whole of it, but what you come to in your conclusion, please.
Sure. So I mean, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. So I'll put it this way: in the book, you know, in the introduction, I have a joke that Albert Einstein is wrong, right? Well, obviously, it's a very provocative claim, you know, and In the spirit of being tongue-in-cheek, you know, I'm not a physicist. I didn't, you know, get claim that he's wrong in the objective sense, obviously, right? But I said that he's wrong because there's a quote of Einstein, you know, and Einstein's whole, you know, philosophical outlook is that we can uncover the secrets of the universe. You know, we can, and that the universe is an inert object that allows us to, not allows us, they don't get a say in it. You know, we're going to get the truth and we're going to discover it. And it's just waiting out there for us to discover. And there's a quote that I put in the beginning of the conclusion that is from Albert Einstein, and it says, "Nature hides its secret because of its essential loftiness, but not by means of ruse." And I found that to be so condescending. You know, because it's almost like the Madonna whore complex, where you're like, you know, this is a good woman, and like really you have, you know, contempt, you know, for them, and you're cheating on them on the side or something, you know, where that's what it reminds me of, because as my book really, I think, you know, tries to demonstrate, the trickster God it has to resort to ruse for our own good. Because we, you know, we are in our enlightenment based, you know, hell bent quest for perfection, you know, perfect good, we are actually causing perfect evil, mm-hmm. Because of our, you know, because of our blindness to this idea of, you know, the inability of bottling otherness, you know, and exchanging otherness as if it's something that can be exchanged and is equivalent to each other, mm-hmm. you know, which it's not. Everything is unique. It's not. It's fundamentally not equivalent. There is much, there's no, you know, equivalence between two people. There's no value that you can assign to one thing or another. And, you know, I think that the trickster God is helping us,
right.
you know, in that way. So there's more to the conclusion than that, but by a lot, but, uh-huh. you know, that I think kind of crystallizes, you know, the universe has our backs.
Okay.
In a weird way, but it does have our backs. So I'll open it up back to you, Chuck, because I know you had a couple of thoughts. No, I wanted to hear them.
Yeah, it's very simple. I think that the best thing to describe this when it comes to a quote, I know you went to the thing you did with Einstein, is really what you started out with to begin with. okay, which is in the introduction, that which is ready to fall, shall ye also push?
Yeah, okay, Nietzsche, yeah.
And that's Nietzsche, and I gotta tell you, I do refer to him sometimes. Voltaire also, when it comes to trying to reason with certain things, but you know, especially the quote about those that are met, you know, are led to believe absurdities will commit atrocities. I find those two quotes go together nicely, by the way, and that's two of my favorites. The thing about this book is, it is not an instruction manual. And a lot of people that attempt to tackle a subject similar to what you have done here would write an instruction manual. And they are given to some serious mistakes when they do that. This is an interesting sort of attitude adjustment that goes on when reading this book. And I don't often experience this reading people's work. I found a different mindset emerging by going through the process that you present here, which is almost like a little bit of magic. You know, you're not directing me, but you are making suggestions, and you are going through this process in your way. But that's not actually important to me as the reader in reading your book. It's a psychological adjustment, which is kind of rare. It's a little bit of magic in a book, actually. Even people that shoot for this kind of thing don't usually accomplish it. So I did not realize that's what it was. I thought, quite frankly, when I first just, you know, gave a glance at your stuff and looked at your background, I was like, okay. Here's a guy, and you and I do and have lived in very different worlds. But I find that you're able to relate your experience here without scolding or condescending to mine, which I find interesting as somebody who tries to tackle this subject and doesn't give me a friggin' cinder block to read. You did it concisely, and I again would recommend this book. So tell people where they can get it, and tell them about your website, which I asked you about, and I know it's dancingwithmyfate.com now. I have it bookmarked. I'll provide it in the show notes, but go ahead and just tell them where they can find you, or again repeat the website for them. I recommend this book. Just that simple. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, Chuck, man, thank you for that. I really appreciate the kind words about it, and that really makes my day that you felt that way, because that's my goal, is to connect, and in a non-judgmental way. I mean, that's my selfish reasons for writing this book, is just to put myself out there and you know, my smoke signal, and hopefully people can see it and, you know, come by the fire, you know, which you did. So that makes me feel really good, Chuck. So thanks. As far as, you know, where people can buy the book, honestly, I prefer, you can get it on my website. There's a link on my website to Aaron Franz's bookshop.org.
Oh, right.
So if people are interested in buying it, buy it from his bookshop.org link that you can get to from my website, or the Age of Transitions website as well. That'd be my preferred way to get the book. If you can't get it there for whatever reason, it is available on, you know, other retailers, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, as a paperback, as well as a Kindle ebook edition.
Well, so I have the paperback, and again, it's not cumbersome. It is a good book, and yeah, sure, absolutely. I didn't even think of it, and I should have. TheAgeOfTransitions.com. Aaron has that bookshop.org site connected to him, and this way, you know what, you can actually support Aaron a little bit, and also I suggest you read this book. It is. I'm not saying it's like, you know, the new Bible, okay? I'm not selling L. Ron Hubbard here and telling you about Dianetics. What I am telling you is that if you go into it even with a remotely open mind, you may actually learn something about yourself, and not because Sam is trying to cram it down your throat. He's making a presentation here, and I appreciate the style and the wit with which he does it. And again, less than 100 pages. Anybody could get through this. Sam Idolette, again, dancingwithmyfate.com is the website, but yeah, go to theageoftransitions.com. Buy it through Aaron's bookstore, and that way he gets a little bit of change. You're gonna pay somebody anyway, so why not support one of the people that gives you good information elsewhere, like Aaron Franz? So, anyway, Sam, I want to thank you for doing this with me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chuck. Thanks for having me on. It was a blast. Hopefully we can do it again sometime.
You know, I may have to, because I'm going to read your book again. I'm just telling you. So I may discover something else. Let's see what happens. In the next hour, we'll be talking to Christy Aphrodite, and she'll be taking questions. So stick around. The Ocelli Effect will return after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times, and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why, and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Ocelli.com.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper.
What are people saying about MyTrueEssence.net? I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
But I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles sort of really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. Essential oils rule!
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination spoken to her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Nibiru, also known as Planet X, was going to get within the gravitational pull of the Earth and cause mass commotion and chaos?
More that. More commotion. More confusion. It goes into the confusion thing. Hey, going nut, he's going back, and it's going crazy.
I hate being confused like that.
But that's exactly how he wants it.
It is, but at the Ocelli.com radio network, you're never confused.
No, it's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
It's about time. Forget this Nibiru stuff and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
.com, and he'd get it right where you want to hear it at. Right straight ahead instead of ding-donging back and forth here.
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect continues now at Ocelli.com, but it could be some other time, some other place, because whoever you are, wherever you are, welcome. As if that made any sense. Christy Aphrodite's with me, and we're gonna take it back to last week, and we're going to get into a few things that she discussed in brief during hour one on Tuesday, but now she's on hour two, and that's where she's going to be for the foreseeable future, it appears. She'll be in that slot as long as she wants to. And we're going to talk about natural solutions. And, it's about that simple, isn't it? Christy, how you doing?
I love that. I'm awesome, Chuck. I had, the busiest day ever, but everything worked out perfectly. And I'm happy to be here with you.
Well, this is the easy part of your day.
Right. I was sweating a little bit, and but thankfully I got done in time enough to get a little bit to eat, because as you know, our topic last week was headaches and not eating and things like that, and working too hard can sometimes contribute to that. So although I would totally torture myself to be here on time for you. But if I don't have to, that's cool.
Look, I really appreciate it. And if you did have to cancel because you're just worn out from the day, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. Let me know. Right. That's all.
No, I'm here, man. I said I'm going to be here, and I'm going to be here.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So where should we start this week? We talked about pain last week. We talked about the idea that there are many things that are there right under your feet a lot of times, no matter where you are, that can be helpful and useful if you identify them, if you understand what is naturally growing around you. Weeds are your friends. Where shall we begin?
Well, Chuck, I want to apologize to your listeners. And, you know, I already told you before we came on my feelings about this show. But I am always open. Anyone who wants to help me or give me constructive criticism, I'm super thankful. And mm-hmm. I am apologizing because I did get feedback about how I was too rushed and gave too much information that, well, yeah, that's cool. You gave people lots of seeds, but that really no tangible, like, okay, that's great. Where do I start? I'm still just as confused as ever. So I thought about that. And that's why I contacted you and asked if that was okay, mm-hmm. because I want to make sure that the listeners get everything they need about this topic. There were, you know, still even more things I wanted to give instructionals. Like we mentioned cannabis piece, if you have extreme pain, but I didn't even tell you how and like the herbs and oils, I went through them so quickly. I feel mm-hmm. that, yeah, I want to be able to answer more questions. I even recall that we missed a question or two in the chat mm-hmm. because I was so in a hurry. We were on a time crunch, or we thought we were, and then it, whatever. So I'm right. sorry about that. And I honestly, I don't want to do that. My intention is not to make things more confusing or to overload. I want people to have information right here, right now, that doesn't cost them a single penny that they could use to improve their lives right when you get off the show. Not like, wait, what did she say?
Okay.
So if that's okay with everybody, thank you, and I'm sorry, but if we do feel sufficient at that, then obviously the next topic we discussed would be anxiety and depression.
Right.
And so if we have, and some of that correlates, right? But yeah, I just think we should do a more succinct version that gives people tangible help if anyone has questions about last week. And of course you, Chuck, and the herbs and what to do with them. Okay, so you said basil. Well, what do I do? Yeah.
Right. Okay. So do you want to start with cannabis paste, or do you want to start with, basic herbs? Where should we begin, Christy?
You know, okay, this is where I want to start because I kind of glossed over it last time. Mm-hmm. Again, the hurry. So let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
And you even brought it up at one point, like, so... And I went over different types of headaches, right? Mm-hmm. But we really have to focus. I just want to say our society has been trained that if you have a pain or an ouchie or something, you need to make it stop right away, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for everything, right? So is it self-inflicted pain? Is it external pain? Is it something from exogenous influences? Is it, you know what I mean? So really, if we're talking about pain or headaches or anything going on, we should always say, first, our first reaction shouldn't be to make it go away, because the pain is the indicator, like the check engine light on the car, that is trying to alert you to something. Now, okay. If it's obvious, like, okay, I'm straining my eyes too much, of course, that's going to give me a headache. Or I carried way too many bags of cement today. Of course my back and my butt's going to hurt, you know?
So your first step is really evaluation, where...
Assess
what is the causation here. Okay, I've got a pain, I've been alerted. So wherever it is, whether it's in your head or your foot or anywhere in between, you say to yourself, okay, so was there some extraneous motion or pressure placed on an area of my body? Was I standing too long? Was I reading too long? Whatever. So these are basic questions that you can ask yourself.
Do I have a sinus infection? Do I have high blood pressure? Mm-hmm. Did I overexert myself? Am I dehydrated? Do I have a food allergy I don't know of? You know, am I super stressed? Do I have a nutritional deficiency?
Or were you exposed to something that's having a negative impact?
Environmental toxins, absolutely. Right. Biological warfare, yeah.
Yeah, that too.
That.
Uh-huh. That thing.
Hunger, even. Hunger? Or aromas, odors, things like that. So we assess that first. Now, some of it's obvious, right? You just got hit on the head or whatever. You're straining your eyes or something. Then, you know, obviously you need to do what you need to do to address the situation once you've ruled out all the other possibilities, right? Because let me tell you, if you have had headaches of unknown origin for like 35 years, you know, there's something going on, right? Mm-hmm. So treating the symptom and making the headache or whatever, the pain go away, isn't actually getting at the root and trying to address the actual problem causing it, right? And so we're taught here, Western medicine is essentially symptom management, and some of it works, and it'll suppress symptoms or whatever, but what else is also going on? And so that's why my approach is to always go to nature first.
Well, right. Now, before you go any further, just a little thing I want to throw in here is that at one time I absolutely helped somebody cure their headaches. They were telling me they had a headache for like 2 months and they couldn't get rid of it. And I just hung out with them for a little while and realized, guess what? They were using a crappy pair of sunglasses.
That's
all there was to it. I said, you gotta get better sunglasses. These things are, I don't know, they're colored plastic, but they're doing you no good. And there is a bit of a science to sunglasses if you need them. And it's something that most people wouldn't even bother to look at. I get them to switch their sunglasses. Guess what? Headache was gone the next day, didn't come back. It was just a matter of what they were allowing to filter into themselves. Another thing you got to watch, air filters in your home, stuff like this. Even if you have air conditioning or whatever, I know a lot of people don't like that kind of, you know, but if you're in the South, I mean, come on, man, you can't survive. You got to watch your filters.
No, you can't. It's essential.
Yeah, so dirty filters could even give you a sinus problem because air is blowing through them still, even though they're dirty.
Right.
So I'm just saying that you got to think about the tangential things as well. Not necessarily was I leaning up against a wall and my shoulder hurts, although that could be too. But sometimes you got to think about the tangential things, and there could be a simple, easy solution. Not always. You eliminate all that stuff. So now we're moving forward, and like you were saying, go ahead. I just wanted to make that little mark there and give you a second to think about where you want to go next.
So I wanted to, in reference to the check engine light and how we are programmed to make our pains or whatever go away without addressing the root, I would just like to encourage people to, you know, maybe you don't have to be as crazy as me and give thanks for your pain, but I use those check engine lights as an opportunity to check myself, check in with God, check in with my soul, what am I not paying attention to, right? or what is this trying to alert me of? And I get deep with that, and I just want to say it doesn't cost anyone a penny. And there are times where I have approached it that way without doing anything, no herb, no nothing. And the process of asking the questions within myself in my own head made it go away, right? So there's that. I would just, in all pain, if we can look at it from a healthier perspective where true traditional cultures did, you know, because everything has a cause, and that physical is only a manifestation of what's going on spiritually, mentally, emotionally, etc. Because, I mean, most of the world is unseen, right? Mm-hmm. So we do, I think if we are more mindful about thoughts that we're suppressing, right? And in particular, headaches. And I just want to say this is true across the board for all head everything, head mm-hmm. aches, head injuries, concussions, mm-hmm. Aneurysms, stroke, seizures, etc. It's all related to, and I'm not trying to simplify this, so when I say these words, I'm not saying that's it, but to a degree. And yes, there's external influences, but what we have control of that causes pain in our head is overthinking, overanalyzing, not feeling good enough, or, you know, not feeling like you've done enough, and obviously the daily stressors, news, work, trying to keep up, pay the bills, and, you know, so how do you not think about that, right? So it, right? So we have to find that balance between dealing with actual reality and the stressors. But my opinion, honestly, turn the TV off, turn the news off. It's not helping you. In fact, you know, news causes headaches. So.
Well, no, there's that, but then there's also generally what I would call worry, which is, right. which could be part of the news cycle, but it could be part of just, you're worried about paying the bills. You're worried about, and that's why I said that toward the end last time about putting it in perspective and saying to yourself, look, I'm allowing an emotional reaction here, which is now festering. And you're worried. You're constantly thinking about, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? What am I going to... That's not healthy for anybody.
Dude, I gave myself strokes. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I'm talking about actual things I've experienced that I know, obviously, and through study, that it's... I own it, you know? Mm-hmm. I contributed to my own ill health.
Right.
And with in the chat room, extra worry and fear and suppressed right. emotions. And I'm looking at a comment in the chat right now, which I actually love. It says, so we are consciously causing pain. And I'm not saying that. What I'm actually saying is that we are unconsciously doing things that cause pain.
Well, right.
So not blaming anyone or doing any of that, no, it's New Age shame and blame stuff.
No,
but
no,
yeah,
no,
we're...
No.
It's We're not always conscious.
Right. And now here's the thing about that word conscious. You can be conscious of the pain you're causing yourself, but you can also be unconscious of it. So,
and they have groups for that, know, and dungeons and, you know.
Well,
right.
It's just, no, but I'm just saying it is possible to be conscious of the pain you're causing yourself, but not be fully aware that you're causing it. It doesn't feel good to worry, like I said. And that is a choice. Sometimes you can reason with it. Like I said, where it's like, look, can I do something about this right now? Or am I just running in circles? And, you know, if you want to run in circles for exercise, that's fine. But at a certain point, exhaustion comes in. And now you're running tired in a circle, emotionally, so to speak. And you don't want to do that. I'm not saying never worry about anything. What I'm saying is... that do it in a way that's constructive. You know, if you got nothing that can be done about the thing you're worried about for the rest of the day, at least tell yourself, you know what, today I'm going to put it down. And
then do something you do love.
Right.
That makes you feel, you know? So, and look, Chuck, I've unconsciously hurt myself as maybe a little more than I've consciously hurt myself. And mm-hmm. so examples like that, overwork or you yourself, you consciously hurt yourself when you know that doing the work you do and do so good at it, and I'm thankful you do it, right? It's a sacrifice. Like you're consciously aware that you're hurting yourself, you know, or causing more eye strain, which in turn causes pain.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's okay, right? It's a conscious choice you're making. So
right.
the more conscious we become about what we choose, and yeah, some of us choose sacrifices, and some of these sacrifices do cause pain. I'm not saying that all sacrifices do or that we have to or whatever, but in your case, you've
well,
an issue for yeah. a really long time. So
yeah.
you're consciously making a decision. So for you and people like you, right, or in that situation, mm-hmm. how do we balance that? Okay, so can we split our time and take breaks from the screen and literally not strain our eyes and go to a dark room or put on a nice cooling compress or give a self massage, go outside, do deep breathing or laughter yoga or, you know, whatever, stretching, whatever, painting, you know, and that's up to you to decide. But if we're consciously hurt, like when I had to start working, and my fingers and, you know, I was crying at work. I hurt so bad. I consciously right. hurt myself because, well, I kind of couldn't live in a tent forever.
Right.
And, you know, so again, we have to find that balance. And
right.
so I had to find that balance with my boss. Okay, I can do this, but I can't do that. And, you know, and so we have to do that with ourselves, right? If we're self-responsible and want to become closer to becoming our own doctor, you know, and what would you tell your son or your daughter or your child, you know, your puppy or your grandma mm-hmm. or your girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, whatever, when you, you know, if they complain of a pain or something going on in their life, what's the advice you would give them? Now, are you taking that advice? Can you actually go draw yourself a bubble bath and give yourself self-care when either the stress or the tension or the pain is too much, mm-hmm. right? And those are much healthier ways of thought than what our mainstream Western medicine culture has programmed us with, right? To just take a pill and make it stop rather than saying, okay, well, what's going on? Is there something deeper? What, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but that's the thing, though, is that, you know, initially when I was growing up, it was like grin and bear it. And then when you can't bear it anymore, we'll give you a pill. And that's been the case ever since.
Right.
Except now, quite honestly, there's no grin and bear it anymore even. It's just take the pill. They skipped a step even in their own program.
Right.
sure. You know, so we got to get back to understanding what is actually causing the circumstance to begin with. It may be
that's number one. Before you look at herbs, before
right.
you go try to find something at the pharmacy or the herb shop or your yard, you know what I mean? Yeah, before you try to stop it, let's at least come to a good idea what it is. Unless it's like a blunt trauma wound, right? Then you just need first aid immediately and figure it out later. But I don't know how often that happens.
Well, as I said to you on the last show, look, as far as needing a battlefield medic, yes, indeed, allopathic medicine has your solutions.
Right.
You know, you need a bone reset. I know how to do that, but not everybody does. So you may require somebody to help you with that. You don't know how to stitch yourself up or you don't have the steadiness of hand to do so. You may require a little assistance. I get that, and that's fine, because that is all about stopping further problems. And there it is. You're
right.
You're cutting off the problem that's only going to get worse. And you need to think about your own psychology, your own spiritual being, your own whole holistic experience the same way. You got to first put a stop to what's causing the problem and then you go to healing. And the first step in that process before you stop the problem is obviously you have to know what the problem is.
Right.
Bleeding.
Right. Instead of, but yeah, so we have to change our mindset, you know, in becoming more responsible for our health instead of just the same, oh, go to the pharmacy or go to the pill cabinet or go, you know, like, wait 5 minutes or something, you know, and ask, how did this happen? Do I need to... Okay, so let me answer this other question in the chat. It said, if Christy came down with a sudden migraine, what's the first thing she would do? Mm-hmm. So the first thing I would do is say, and I'm not saying everybody has to be like this, and I've been on this path for a long time, but I literally do give thanks for being here, and what am I not paying attention to? And the first question, oh man, I didn't drink enough water. The first thing I do is drink water. Always. First thing. Mm-hmm. Second thing I do is think, oh, when's the last time I ate? Okay. And if I go through the process, I drink the water, I get myself something to eat. And if that doesn't do it, then my next step would be either to make a nice tea with what I have, but before the tea would be grab my peppermint oil and I would inhale it. Mm-hmm. And I would rub it on my temples or wherever the headache or migraine was, my temples and my sinuses, my nose, under my nose, and I would take deep breaths with both nostrils and then blocking one nostril at a time. At long, slow, deep breaths. So I would do that. One inhale each nostril and an inhale with both nostrils. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if that didn't work, my next step would definitely be my Pain Be Gone cream. And I don't think I've never been beyond that step before. But... Okay. If I had to go beyond that step, then it clearly wasn't a dehydration headache or a lack of food headache. Mm. Okay, so then I would be questioning, okay, am I having fear over something? Am I not feeling good enough? What am I stressed out about? Did I watch too much news? Am I fearing things I could do nothing about? I would have those conversations in my head. Mm-hmm. And... you know, check myself if it was to the point where that didn't work or none of those worked, you know, it might be x-ray time, right? Like, so that's where it goes into the other assessments. Like, am I having a sinus congestion? Do I have an infection going on somewhere, right? Infections can cause headaches. Am I having a high blood pressure or a low blood pressure headache, right? Or, you know, what did I eat? If I ate something unfamiliar or in a package or at a restaurant, I probably already read the ingredients, but I would take note if there was something that I ate that I'm not used to eating or in an unfamiliar place, right?
Yeah, see, the only thing I would add to what you're saying, Christy, and I have to because I'm more ABCs about this than you are, and you might have not thought about this directly when you said it, but for me, I've suffered many a migraine. So my first thing is shut down. You stop doing what you're doing, okay? And because that indeed could be the problem. And what I do is secure myself in a place where I can shut my eyes, I can stop paying attention to other things.
Right. Dark room, right.
And I can focus and say, okay, now what is my body temperature at? And then I start doing the rest of what you're talking about. How much water? Was there an extended amount of time? How much sleep was my last sleep cycle? All of these things, food, all those things. And they could be very simple, easy fixes. I've eaten too much of something. I've not eaten enough. I've had not enough water. So on. And all those things going straight through. And then you have these other solutions that if you have them at hand, they help.
Because most of the... you know, many of the causes don't need any medicine. Like water is your medicine, or that dark room time, close your eyes, use a compress, you know, something gentle like chamomile or again, the massage or a salt bath or essential oils, aromatherapy, of course, you know, a nice, yeah. So music, that's another big one, right? Music can help people relax, or whatever your hobby is. Are you a painter? Do you play badminton? Do you, you know, play in nature, wild forage, or just lay in the grass, or, you know, so yeah, most of the time in headaches, each of those non-medicine things can help. So yeah, now, I mean, I guess, so if we're past that and you have, say, herbs in your cabinet or in your garden, and you want to start using some of the herbs we talked about last week, like, say, skullcap or passion flower, rosemary, rose, chamomile, basil, lavender, nutmeg, thyme. As I mentioned, it was all the culinary herbs. But if you want to play with those, I mean, you can simply just add many, if not most of them, to your food. You can, if you have, I did discuss a little bit last week, if you have access to a willow tree, and not just white willow bark, but any willow tree will work, okay? But white willow, if you are able to discern the difference and you do have a choice, that does have the higher content of the salicylic acid, the salicin, the active ingredient in aspirin. But, you know, aspirin hurts your belly because it's just one compound, not the way nature made it, right? With everything else to help yourself. So any or all of those herbs you could either add to your food, increase them on, you know, and even if you eat pizza every day, perfect. Then, like, totally, like, double, triple, quadruple basil, oregano, garlic, pile it on, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you have oatmeal or even fresh ground coffee, right? If you grind your coffee, you can even grind up cinnamon or star anise or nutmeg with your beans, mm-hmm. and even vanilla. And that's, in fact, I have a video. That's how I grind my coffee. So, right. And those are, and ginger, those are all anti-headache remedies and anti-inflammatories and antibacterial. So
yeah, vanilla, vanilla's
you're
been
sneaking your medicine right. in with food, right? Mm. Make it a daily part, and then you won't hopefully ever actually need it as medicine, right?
Right. Now, vanilla, I'm going to tell you, I use all the time, but it's very difficult to get a hold of natural vanilla right now where I am. And it is very helpful. A lot of people wouldn't think of it, and you got to be careful. It's not the crap that's on the grocery store shelf usually.
Right.
So
I'm going to tell you how to make your own really quick.
Okay.
And I'll just say this, if you're having trouble getting affordable any type of food ingredients, I hope I don't get in trouble for this, but there's a website called Webstarunt.com, and they charge a membership, but it's kind of like Amazon, so you get your 30 days free, right?
Okay.
And they deliver to restaurants and all of that. So if you can't find vanilla, you could get it there. If you want to make your own and you can't find vanilla beans anywhere, then go there, you know what I'm saying, and make it a nice order, sign up, and then cancel before the 30 days, and
well,
you know?
No, I understand, but really quickly, are you sure that they don't use anything that's GMO there? Because there are GMO vanilla beans.
They have a store. They're like, it's like going Kraft food. You know, if you've ever worked in Cisco Foods.
Yeah, I got you.
They
okay.
have everything under the sun. So do you want organic and nice and natural? Do you want...
Oh, so
you
can get
you
both.
Have a choice.
Okay. Oh, okay. You can get both. I got you. No, as soon as you said craft, I get it.
Yeah, you could get your toilet paper there. You know what I'm saying?
No. I got you.
Or candles, okay. Or plastic wrap, or things that, you know what I mean.
I got
and
you.
they'll last you forever. So there's a tip. So to make your own vanilla, all you literally need is just like any other tincture, vanilla beans and alcohol. So what alcohol do you want to use? Do you want bourbon? Do you want, you know, that's a common one. Some people even use like spiced rum, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's your choice. And let it, you know, 2 months, I recommend for a tincture. And you can always go longer, especially if you're going to tincture or make an extract, right? Mm-hmm. Vanilla extract or almond extract. You can do the same with coffee beans. You can do the same with cinnamon sticks. You can do the same with anise. You can do the same thing with cloves. And you can have all your own natural food extracts that also happen to be headache remedies mm-hmm. and medicine available when you need it. And you can flavor your cake or anything else.
Well, there you go. I mean, I like to flavor drinks with vanilla. So, I mean, it's just, again, I use caffeine a bit, which we did touch on briefly last time that caffeine for some people is very useful. And right. It has been consistently useful for me. So I do consume it. I recognize that there are drawbacks to that. The drawbacks are outnumbered by the benefits for me.
Right. I'm a coffee drinker. I mean, I don't, well, anymore drink gas station coffee. You know, I'm not on the road all the time, but I do get fair trade and I grind it and do my little, you know, try to make everything I consume medicine. Like I mentioned with the cinnamon, anise, ginger, nutmeg. Vanilla.
Now, really quickly here, because
into grinding your own beans.
Right. Now, really quickly here, somebody said in the chat room they're feeling a little overwhelmed. Maybe we should talk about making a tincture because you mentioned them. You know, the methodology that I'm used to is the hang it in a. Let me just be blunt. You take a bit of a lady's pantyhose, and you wrap your substance in that, whatever it is. you know where I'm going here, right?
That's a great idea, man.
Okay, so the alcohol doesn't destroy it, and it works as its own little filter. Don't get the cheap ones. Get the decent ones. And don't use used ones. Okay, brand new, all right? Just saying.
Hey!
Okay, but you can...
I love that, and it's ingenious in the fact that you or somebody came up with that. That's great. I don't know what they're made out of, so... But if I was desperate, I wouldn't care if right. that's all I had. But truly, you don't actually need that at all, even though it's an awesome idea, right? Mm-hmm. And you could use like a cheesecloth or something like that. Again, awesome idea. You don't need it. Fill your, say you have a, I don't know how much tincture you're going to make, like a little 4 ounce mason jar, 8 ounce. Like I like mine as potent as possible. So I fill my jars all the way to the top with herb. So whether that's forsythia, which I just started preparing, which will be ready in a couple months. Mm-hmm. Or dandelions or whatever, I fill the jar. And this is just a folk method, right? And there's people that teach the science and measure this and weigh that and be... I'm not that girl.
Okay.
Okay. And honestly, it makes it too complicated. Like talk to any generation who's older than us. Like, they all did crazy stuff and... that we think is crazy now, but it works. So really, trust yourself, trust nature. Just fill the damn jar as much as you have with the herb and then cover it with alcohol. And somebody in the text hat said moonshine, and absolutely, I prefer anything homemade in my products. So if you can do that, definitely. But what you're really going for is essentially a 50-50 water alcohol content, right? So if you're buying, say, a vodka at a liquor store, it's most likely 80 proof, right? You got 40%. Right. Well, that's not enough alcohol to get all of the alcohol soluble properties. And that's where, when we get into health food stores and meeting regulations and things like that, they're not as potent as maybe making them yourself or finding a local herbalist or apothecary. So fill it and make sure when you put your choice of alcohol, try to get to 50%. You know, so if you can get something that's 100 proof, then there you go, it's easy. But you also have to keep in mind whether you're tincturing, say, something like a high water content, like basil, for example, or mint, versus echinacea. Echinacea leaves are dry and hard, and, you know, so there are simple variations there. But if you shoot for 50%, or 55% if you're unsure, right? Because alcohol is also a preservative. Mm-hmm. So tinctures are going to last forever, okay? Right.
So back to the process, though, okay? Because generally speaking, you can do this process the same way with everything, but as you said, you'll have different results. Now, we fill it halfway with, all the way with the herb.
Whatever size jar you're using, fill it to the top with herb. And we're talking fresh herb here, not dried herb.
Right.
And the reason is because with the alcohol, you're also preserving the water-soluble characteristics of the plant, right?
Okay.
Because different menstruums, which could be water, liquor, oil, vinegar, right?
Okay.
They absorb different properties from the plant.
Okay.
So the alcohol and the water, like if you do, say, for example, Everclear with your echinacea or something, mm-hmm. I mean, number one, it's going to be horrible. Number two, it will be potentially dangerous. And three, there's no water soluble properties, so you're not getting the whole plant again, right? So we might as well just make an aspirin.
You might as well just crush it up and use it as a powder if you're going to do that.
Exactly. For alcohol, use fresh herbs, not dried.
Right.
And you know then cover the herb, however tall you fill your glass with whatever herb you're using, cover it with the alcohol.
Okay.
And then put a lid on it and treat it like a headache and put it in a dark room. And every day or every time you remember, hopefully once a day or at least every other day, go in and shake it up. And I'm going to say again, give thanks, right? And also give thanks when you're picking the herb, like every single leaf. I have to include that.
Mm-hmm. Look, giving thanks while you're creating medicine, as some people think that sounds hokey, it is, it's necessary. Please do it.
Absolutely. And respect, right? You can't
respect.
Be like mm-hmm. torturing or, you know, doing bad things to yourself and then be like, oh, here, God help me. You know, like I'm just going to have this here and I'm not even going to say thank you for this precious herb and medicine that's growing freely, you know?
Right.
Yeah, give thanks, please.
thanks to the creator, thanks to Mother Earth, something.
Anyone you want. I'm not going to name God or anything like that.
Oh, no, that was my point. Doesn't matter, just give thanks for the creation of said thing.
The
period.
Flower, right.
Right.
Just the beautiful leaf, the beautiful fragrance.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm just going to mention this in case you're new. Like, I don't bring any herb into my house, you know, after I clip it, that has any wilt or any brown or any spot or anything like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So feel free to cut all that off. And again, give thanks, return it to the earth in the bed, but don't put it in your medicine.
So how long do you need to leave? I'm just going to paint a picture here. You put it in your closet on the top shelf, where generally not a lot of light is going to come in, and you got a chance to see it once a day if you go into your closet, so you won't forget to shake it up once every other day. Christy said you could do it. I agree with that too. You know, sometimes people forget, But how we're many days?
We're gonna forget, right? And then we'll add pressure on ourselves, like, oh my god, I forgot, and then we get a headache and that counteracts what we're doing in the damn first place.
So
right?
don't
be easy on yourself.
Yeah, don't stress about it, but try and keep in mind it's good to shake it up every so often. Okay.
Yeah.
So now it's up on the closet shelf. How many days do you think is good before we're gonna take the next step?
2 months. Some people do 6 weeks. I always recommend 2 months, and some I do even longer in the case of roots, whether that's a yellow dock or a mullein root or dandelion root, or what's the other root I did? Pokeweed root.
Pokeweed, okay.
Yeah, that's been tincturing actually for 4 at least 5 months, at least 4, maybe even 5 now.
Let me give one other piece of advice here, is that masking tape is your friend, and what you should do is write on it the date that you put it in the closet, because here we are that you might forget about it or take it out too soon. So I would put the date on it when
always,
you put it in.
Name and date. Always.
Name and date, so you know what it is in case you're tincturing more than one thing or you just forgot.
And if you're tincturing more than one thing, which alcohol or oil or vinegar, right? Write that down too. And I work with multiple oils here. So is this a baobab oil? Is this a pomegranate seed oil?
Right.
Is this sunflower oil?
Right.
Because you will forget, I promise you. And I have a pretty good mind for not forgetting a lot of that kind of stuff, but even I forget. Even things that I'm like, oh, I'll never forget. Well, I'll forget. You'll forget.
I got you. That's why I'm throwing these things in, just to try and help. So, 60 days. Let's just say that they waited the 60 days. They know what it is. They're taking it out. Okay, now what do you recommend somebody does with said mason jar?
Okay. So you can either use your nylon trick if it wasn't already in there or cheesecloth or muslin. But honestly, a nice simple way and something that probably everyone has is a big bowl and a sieve.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And then put a coffee filter in it. And I do that twice.
Right, straining with a coffee filter, I would recommend doing it more than once. And you can use, coffee filters are fairly cheap. So, and if you already have them around the house, you already have them. So,
yeah, and if you want to, like I said, if you're using, and I have a press and things for it. So you could use cheesecloth and a press, but really it's not necessary. You can just let it do its own thing and strain it at least twice. Sometimes I do three, if there's a particle that I see or whatever, because you're dealing with fresh herb, and also in the fresh herb is bee pollen, and if you picked them fresh, right? So there's all sorts of stuff. Well, hopefully not, because I guess maybe we skipped another step when you're picking the herb. I said pull off all the other stuff. I always put it in like a colander or a basket and shake it, because there'll be like little insects or something like that, right? And it doesn't matter if one gets in there, that it's going to die in the alcohol anyways, and you'll strain it out. But still, if you don't want that extra protein, just shake the dandelion flowers or whatever in the colander a few times, or depending on how much or what I have, I'll put like a metal rack, and let it sit on there, or a screen, and shake it and get off all the particles, then put it in the jar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. So now you have your clean tincture, because you've filtered it, you've preserved it, you've allowed it to do its process with the alcohol, which is a great little advantage. Of course, if you can use, like you said, natural stuff, something homemade, good deal. And I've heard about a different process for doing this with wine, but we'll get into that another time.
Like a dandelion wine or something?
Yeah, yeah. But we'll get into that another time, because we're going to run up against it, and I want to finish this. So Now you have this. You have it clean, and assuming you put it back into a mason jar, a clean mason jar, right? Clean out your jar. Go ahead and put the clean product back in it. Now, how should we store this thing?
A dark bottle, a dark glass is always preferred. Mm-hmm. But if a mason jar is all you have to store the finished product in, then maybe consider, again, keeping it in a dark room or wrapping a paper or tape or something around it.
Right. You don't want it to get exposed to light too much at all. And
any herbal products or fresh herbs or infusions.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, there's a reason why good olive oil comes in a dark bottle. There's a reason why, you know, good natural stuff often comes in a dark bottle, is that you don't want the light to unnecessarily heat it up or to add energy to it, which could cause it to resprout and this kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying your tincture will resprout. I'm just saying that, you know.
You never know.
if you have tincture resprouting, write me an email. Let me know about it because I want to see this.
But, I do too. You'll be the first, second.
but either way, I'll pass it along to you. But the thing is that, you got to be careful with it afterwards. Now, some stuff is good to put in the refrigerator and some stuff is not, right?
Yeah, so if you were, say, tincturing a fresh herb with a vinegar, mm-hmm. or and you always want to use dry herbs with oil, and mm-hmm. that's because simply water plus bacteria or oil equals bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So make sure your herbs are thoroughly dried before you tincture them in oil. And depending on the type of oil or quality or how long you're going to keep it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I, like my fine oils and my products, they all, no question, they go in the fridge. I'm not even going to take a chance for something to spoil or whatever, right? But yeah, how much are you making at a time? Are you using it for cooking? Are you using it for skincare? Are you using it just to, like we talked about, some of the pastes or things that you could quickly make with kitchen cabinet ingredients?
Well, yeah, now you and I talked about that off the air, and maybe we'll get to that next time. Maybe we won't. We'll see what happens because we're almost out of time. And I think what you provided here is a very good set of guidelines. If somebody wants to take this into their own hands and attempt to make, I shouldn't say attempt, forget attempt. You want to make a tincture yourself. You basically just got schooled on it. So I think that's pretty solid. And
it's not hard. That's what people need to understand, because we're taught that we're not smart enough to do that. Like, we don't, you know what I mean?
Right.
We need some expert. No, you don't.
What did we talk about here? You know, if you have coffee filters, a mason jar, and the materials you want to work with, done. It's
You're
not
done.
Like there's 100 things. So it's very simple, and I can tell you that making all sorts of these things, they all have different, you know, purposes, as per usual. But having done this myself as well, you'll learn as you do it. Maybe a methodology you'll change a little bit and say, okay, I'd rather strain it this way, that way. Maybe I want to do it in a cold room. You know, it depends on your circumstances and what you have available to you, but you are capable of it if you choose to do this.
Yes.
So, Christy, with that, I give it to you to close the hour because we're actually done.
Another question came up on the chat. Can I just buy it from Christy? So I will say yes, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm always honored to help people. But I'm not trying to create dependence either, right? So I am just as happy to make a product for you as I am to teach you how to do it yourself. But if you did want to do that, then mytrueessence.net would be the site you check out. And if you have any questions or anything like that, just feel free to send me an email, mm-hmm. and I will get back to you. It might not always be right away, but I will, and I'll help in any way I can.
Right. Christy is doing exactly that, trying to help in any way she can. And one of the ways that she's helping is passing on some very simple, very basic knowledge that, quite frankly, a lot of our ancestors had and we seem to have lost track of. Anyway, natural solutions are a possibility, and mytrueessence.net, yes, you can go over there and purchase products, but you can also contact Christy and find out how to make your own medicine, additives, and assistance, all brought to you by nature. I want to thank Sam Idolette for talking with me in the first hour about his book, Dancing with My Fate, and also Christy Aphrodite. Wow.
Wait, what'd you just call me?
I called you Chris Christie. Christy Aphrodite, as I try to close out the show. Christy Aphrodite.
So we might get a concussion. Oh, wait. Sorry.
Already beat you to it 8 times. Anyways, it is what it is. I love you, Christy. You know that. I didn't mean to call you that. So don't hold it against me.
I know.
Anyway, we'll be back tomorrow night, I assure you. And Christy will be back next week. So meanwhile, keep in mind that I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.